Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus in biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to John Aitken about the new book, The Infertility Trap: Why Life Choices Impact Your Fertility and Why We Must Act Now. A potential crisis in human fertility is brewing. As societies become more affluent, they experience changes that have a dramatic impact on reproduction. This book will address, in a unique and multifaceted way, how the consequences of modern life affect fertility so that we can consider behavioral, social, medical, and environmental changes, which could reduce the severity of what is about to come. Well, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So how are you? How was your week?
So I had a great week, very, very busy week. This is a very busy time for us. We're engaged in a lot of research currently. So I was very occupied during the course of the last week.
Catching a bit of a sunshine on Sunday.
We had great weather this weekend. Of course, I'm in the Southern Hemisphere, so this is our winter. But it was a bright, shiny, but cool, crisp day. And yeah, lovely. Very, very good.
Excellent. So can you tell us, what do you do?
So you want to hear a little bit about my background?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. So basically, my career started way back in the late 60s. I left home, my rural home in the west of England, and went to London because this was 1966, and London was in full swing at that time. And I rather inadvertently, over the course of 3 years, got a degree in zoology, and left 3 years later with degree in hand and a very detailed knowledge of the evolution of the reptilian skull, but not really much idea about what I was going to do career-wise. And then I had the enormous good luck of being offered a PhD position at the University of Cambridge in the laboratory of Roger Short, who was probably one of the greatest reproductive biologists of his generation. And he took me on board and basically enthused me about the whole subject of reproductive biology. And I have been a reproductive biologist ever since. I left Cambridge, went to Edinburgh and also France, did a series of postdocs. Then actually I worked for the World Health Organization for a while, because at the time we were very concerned about uncontrolled population growth, and as was the World Health Organization, and they set up a unit to study better ways in which we could try to control human fertility. After that was over, I went back to Edinburgh. And by this time, Roger Short had moved to Edinburgh and set up a medical research council research unit focusing entirely on reproductive biology. And I worked with them for about 25 years, became a professor there and ran a research group studying reproductive biology, but particularly the male, because male infertility is very prevalent. And yet we know very little about its origins. So we did a lot of work on the infertile male to try to understand why men lose their fertility so frequently. And then one day in about 1997, I got a random phone call from somebody I didn't know, who said that they just had a search committee meeting, and they were interested to know if I was interested in a job, a chair at the University of Newcastle. And I thought they meant Newcastle on Tyne. So I politely declined. And they said, well, that's a pity, because we would have paid your airfare to come out and have a look at us. So I had to say, well, can you orientate me? Where are you speaking to me from? And he explained that there was another Newcastle far, far away on the east coast of Australia. So I came out and had a look and loved the university and the people here. So I moved from Scotland, where I'd spent the last 25 years, to Australia. And here I set up a research group, the Priority Research Centre, looking into reproductive health, which is still up and running today. I got briefly diverted to become Pro Vice Chancellor of Health and Medicine. So I ran the medical faculty for about 7 years. But now I am retired and able to focus entirely on the things that interest me. And the thing that really interests me at the moment is are the causes of human infertility. And that's the topic on which I've recently written this book, The Infertility Trap.
Wow, that's an impressive career journey. So I was wondering if you have anything to say to our student listeners, early career researchers, and especially what do you like about being in academia?
Okay, that's a really great question. I think, you know, being in academia is a wonderful privilege to begin with. You get the opportunity to pursue your intellectual passions, and basically you won't get anywhere in academia unless you're passionate about your subject. So I tell my students that if they're engaged in academia, there are three things that they have to do. First of all, they have to be passionate about what they do, passionate about their subject, and intellectually interested in its future development. Second thing they have to do is to work extremely hard. Life in academia is not for the faint-hearted, is extremely competitive. Unless you're prepared to work as hard as your competitors in North America or Europe, you can't make headway in this business. And then the third thing, and it's equally important, is you have to have a bit of showbiz about you, because at the end of the day, you've got to be able to convince people about the originality and the value of your ideas. And it doesn't matter if it's a cynical audience listening to one of your research presentations, or it's a funding agency wondering whether or not they're going to give you a grant. You have to be able to communicate the things that you do in an erudite and enthusiastic manner so that you can get funded and continue to do the work that you love. So those are, any students listening, I would say those are the three major things. You have to be passionate and intellectually engaged. You have to be prepared to work extremely hard. And you have to focus very much on communicating your ideas so you convince others that your ideas have value and potential.
Oh, what a great advice. So your latest book, The Infertility Trap, Why Life Choices Impact Your Fertility and Why We Must Act Now. So how did you come to writing it?
So it's really had, a very long evolution. It's something I've been interested in the background about the development of the human population. Many people think that, you know, humankind has evolved to some sort of state of Darwinian perfection and can now look down with a degree of arrogance and superiority on all the other living things in the biosphere. But in truth, we are still evolving. And the future fate of humanity is something that interests me a great deal. For most of my professional life, I've been a biochemist, and I've studied basically the cell biology of the reproductive process. But 2 years ago, I retired from my academic position and now had the opportunity to think more broadly about how the work that I'd done for the previous 40 years or so actually fitted into a larger landscape. And so I started to write this book. I think in many ways I was aided by the COVID pandemic, because we were locked down anyway. So I had to find something to do during the lockdown periods, and writing a book seemed a very reasonable thing to do. I pitched the idea of the book to Cambridge University Press, and happily they were very enthusiastic about it. So I knew that I had publishers ready to receive the text when I'd written it. And I spent the next 18 months basically putting together the arguments that are at the core of this book on the infertility trap.
Excellent. So let's dive into some of those arguments that you present in your book. And can we start with a very basic question? So is there really a crisis in human fertility?
Okay, that's a great question and a good place to start, as you point out. So look, for most of my life, I've not been worried about population decline. I've been concerned about the opposite, which is excessive population growth. And to convince people that there is going to be a pending crisis involving population decline is actually very difficult at the present time, because every minute of every day, we are surrounded by evidence of overpopulation, whether this is the high levels of pollution we live with, pandemic diseases, or all the manifestations of climate change. All these things tell us that we have an excessive number of people on the planet, and that some correction in our population numbers would be a good thing. And I guess the message in the book is, yes, this is the case. And in fact, this will happen. And already the seeds are sown of population decline. And there are a number of things now working to drive down human population numbers. We'll probably keep on increasing our numbers for the next 10 years or so. But then the numbers, population numbers will start to decline. And what I'm trying to do is to make people aware of the various forces that are going to drive population decline, because we don't want this to be an uncontrolled process. If we're not prepared for it and it suddenly happens, it may be a very difficult process to stop. In many ways, I think it's a lot like climate change. Climate change was very difficult to, as an argument, to get any traction, because the time scale of climate change is too long for, you know, the attention span of the average individual. These are not things that happen over 3 to 5 year cycles. These are things that happen over decades, if not centuries. And the fate of the human population has really been sown already. We are seeing reduced fertility rates all over the world. And this is going to manifest itself in rapid population decline, but not now, not next year, but probably in 20 or 30 years' time, we'll see the beginning of population change. It won't be consistent across all countries. Some countries will show population decline earlier than others. And I think China has already turned the corner, and its population is now declining, on the decline. The total number of people, not just their fertility is declining, but also the number of people in China is declining. So they, in many ways, are going to be the forerunner of what is going to happen in many other countries.
So what are some of the ways that you study human fertility, populations, and global demographics?
Yeah, so, you know, we're very fortunate in that there are very good databases available from the World Bank and the United Nations. So what I've been doing is putting together those databases and trying to make sense of the various changes that we see, both in fertility rates, but also in other things like global productivity, affluence, the role of education, the role of contraception, the role of urbanization. These are all factors that we know impinge on population numbers. So it's been, I guess, a year and a half of putting together all that data that is available and trying to isolate what the various forces are that are going to drive down human populations. And in essence, there are three major causes. There's the short-term causes, which are extremely powerful and are largely social. Then there are some intermediate level causes that will work out over the next 20 or 30 years, which are very much lifestyle and environment induced. And then finally, there are very long-term changes, which are evolutionary changes in our fundamental fertility. So all of these things are going to have an impact on total population numbers, but they will operate at different times with different levels of severity.
So to understand this field a little bit more, can you present us with some of the terminology and some of the concepts that we should think about?
Okay, so I'm not a demographer, but central to sort of demographic concepts is a process known as the demographic transition. And what this essentially says is the following, that when our species was evolving, and we've been on the planet now for, 200,000 years or so, so we've been here a long time. For most of that time, our population numbers were very low. Essentially, we had a high birth rate that was matched by a high death rate, and population numbers were stable and sustainable. And then I guess things really started to change after the first industrial revolution. And societies, not all of them, but some of them, started to become very affluent. And as countries go through the socioeconomic development spectrum, they always lose fertility. And the reason for that is that one of the first things that happens when societies become more affluent is that childhood and infant mortality rates go down. So if you're a Paleolithic family, you have to have five or six children because probably four or five of them are going to die before they reach reproductive age. But as we become more affluent and we have a better grasp of providing safe, healthy environments for our children, so infant mortality rates come down. And then there's no need to have a large family, because if you only have three or four children, you know they're all going to survive. So fertility rates come down as a natural part of the demographic transition. To some extent, that doesn't have a massive impact immediately on population numbers, because the other thing that happens with affluence is we live longer. Mm. So that helps keep numbers of people on the planet. But in the end, the reduced fertility rates are going to result in a decline in the population. And you see that very dramatically in Southeast Asia. If you look at the tiger economies like Taiwan or South Korea or Singapore, their populations increased slightly after the war. There was a lot of optimism. And the average family size in Taiwan, South Korea, and Singapore would have been somewhere between 7 and 8 at that time. And then following their socioeconomic development, their fertility rates, that is the number of children born per woman, declined dramatically. And so all those countries now have the lowest fertility rates in the world. They have a fertility rate of only just above 1. So another demographic principle is a couple, a man and a woman, have to have at least 2.1 children in order to maintain the population at a constant level. So if your fertility rate goes below 2.1, then the population is bound to decline. And this has happened in those tiger economies. It's happened throughout the developed world, Australia, most countries in Europe, the USA. We all have fertility rates, which are now below replacement. So it's inevitable that the population will decline. And, you know, an interesting series of questions then are raised about, this decline has been extremely dramatic. What is it that's driving it? And a lot of the arguments of the book are about trying to understand the driving forces behind this very dramatic decline in human fertility. And I guess one of the first concepts to get out of the way is the Malthusian concept. So Malthus was a philosopher who had an idea about populations, which was essentially they grow as a geometric progression. In other words, they grow exponentially, but the resources that sustain those populations can only grow in a linear fashion arithmetically. So the result is that most populations outstrip the resources that are needed to sustain them, and essentially they starve to death. And in the 1960s, a very powerful book was written by Paul Ehrlich called The Population Bomb. And this influenced a lot of people's thinking. And he basically took a Malthusian concept to his logical conclusion and said that in the end, human populations will grow to the point where they use up all the resources that are available, and then they will essentially starve to death. And in his book, he said that by 2020, and remember, this book was written in 1968, he said that by 2020, the United Kingdom would consist of 70 million very impoverished, very hungry people. Well, he was right on the number. I don't think they're impoverished, and they're certainly not hungry. So in fact, as our fertility rates have come down, our capacity to generate food, and I'm talking here globally, our capacity to generate both crops and animal products has increased. So, you know, the reason why fertility rates are falling has got nothing to do with the ability to generate the resources needed to sustain the population. We've got plenty of resources. The reason the populations have come down is something to do with affluence. It's whenever populations become affluent, you see fertility rates decline. So that obviously leads then to questions about how affluence drives infertility. And one of the most powerful ones is certainly female education. So all over the world, we are very happily seeing an increase in female education. But as soon as female education rates start to increase, birth rates come down for very obvious reasons. When women become educated, they become empowered to make decisions about what kind of family they want. There is no need in more affluent societies to have large numbers of children. And they very rightly express their willingness to enter the workforce and express themselves through their professional activities. So there is kind of shift, I think, in the purpose of existence. It's no longer just about having children. Both genders, men and women, on a voyage to sort of self-fulfillment and realizing their potential. And it's not necessarily just about having children. And indeed now, childlessness is relatively common. At least one in four women won't have any children, and is there is no stigma attached to that. In fact, childless, successful professional women are a role model for many young girls these days. So that, you know, it's a good thing that female education has arisen, and it's an unfortunate consequence of that is that fertility rates decline. And in many ways, it's a kind of virtuous cycle, because the more prosperous you are, the lower the infant mortality rates are. That means that your fertility rates come down. That means that women have more opportunity to become educated. So that increases the prosperity of the country and so on. So you go around in this kind of virtuous cycle. But what gets lost in this virtuous cycle is our biology. We are a very unusual species in that we stop reproducing in midlife. Most species, a laboratory rat or a wallaby jumping around the park where I'm currently talking to you from, they will reproduce until the day they die, but not us. We stop reproducing in midlife. And this creates a major problem for women. Because if they engage in developing their professional activities, and only when their careers are established that they turn to the concept of having a family, they're beginning to enter those years when fertility starts to spontaneously decline. And in all women, it declines between the ages of roughly 35 and 42. Fertility is lost. So this is a major issue for us. And you know, in many ways, we can control many things about our environment and the way that we organize society. But the one thing we cannot control is our biology. So we can't sort of ignore this as a fact. This is part of the human condition. And we somehow have to rethink the way that we structure society in order to allow women to achieve their twin goals of having a professional career and having a family, if that's what they want. They should be enabled to do that. And it's a kind of a modern day tragedy that there are thousands of women in IVF programs hoping that IVF will rescue their age-dependent infertility, and it won't. It's one thing IVF cannot do is improve the fertility of a 42-year-old woman. So we can't keep banging our heads against that particular brick wall. We have to wake up to the fact that fertility does decline between the ages of 35 and 42, and somehow as a society accommodate and encourage people, if they want to have a family, to have them earlier in life and not wait for that period of time when spontaneous infertility arrives. And this is the kind of thing that I think Scandinavian countries are very good at. This is about providing parental support schemes that now allow couples to have children and not suffer from too much interruption of their career development. It's about engaging both men and women in the child-rearing process so that the load and responsibilities are equally shared between the two partners. It's all those kind of things that we need to engage in. The one thing we cannot do is just keep relying on IVF to solve the problem, because it can't. And it's, as I said, it's a kind of modern day tragedy that people put their faith in this technology to help them. IVF is a wonderful technology. It's enabled the creation of literally millions of children that would not otherwise have existed. But this is the one area where it just can't help very much. So, you know, that's one of the major sort of social issues. Another one is that we've become progressively urbanized all over the world. Even Africa is now, you know, becoming increasingly urbanized. And when you move to more urban environments, it automatically has a negative effect on family size. So there's just limited space to have a large family if you're living in a two-room apartment. In a city environment, women will have improved access to work and education. So that, again, counts against having large families. In an urban environment, women will have, and men, will have access to improved access to contraception. And also something which I'll go on to in a minute is that in urban environments, there's often high levels of pollution and disease that impair fertility. And then the other issue, which is really interesting, and I was quite surprised when I went into the databases and found this, but in all modern industrialized societies, as the average family size gets reduced to around about two, so roughly replacement level, marriage rates drop like a stone. So throughout the developed world, we've seen a reduction in the number of couples that are getting married. And in the beginning, I think people get married because they want to have children. So this is both a symptom and a cause. It's that people have discovered that they don't necessarily want to have children, so the need to get married decreases. But also in parallel with that, we're seeing increased numbers of children born outside of marriage. So in a way, one of the social constructs which is suffering in modern day society is the concept of marriage. And that's another sort of social thing that we have to think about, which is having an impact on reproduction. So, you know, those are some of the major sort of social things that are causing infertility. By far the most powerful is the reduction in infant mortality and the resulting increase in the opportunities of women to become educated. And then the consequential delay in them trying to establish a family. And if you leave it to you're over the age of 35, it can become problematic. Not for everybody, but for some people it will be.
And how does male infertility look like?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So that brings me nicely on to other causes, and particularly environmental and lifestyle causes. So male infertility is, or first of all, human male fertility is very low. As a species, men are relatively infertile. So we measure fertility as a fecundity rate. So if, again, if you're a laboratory rat or a feral wallaby, every time you have intercourse with a female in estrus, they will get pregnant. Pretty much every time. So fecundity is close to 100%. in our species, even under the best of circumstances, fecundity is around about 25%. So only one in four acts of insemination will result in a pregnancy in our species. So we start from a very low base. We have very poor fertility to begin with, and this is associated with very poor semen quality in men. And then against that background, we have this phenomenon that it took a long time for people to believe. This phenomenon was first described in the early 90s, and it was widely disputed and said it couldn't possibly be true. And this is the phenomenon of declining sperm counts. So the idea that the average sperm count per male has been decreasing with time. But now we've had some really large studies done, and it's, I think, now incontrovertible, irrefutable, that sperm counts are declining all over the world. And as a rough figure, we would say that sperm counts have halved in the last 50 years. So whereas sperm counts used to be roughly 100 million per mil, they're now somewhere around 50 million per mil. So something is happening in the environment that is leading to a decline in sperm count. And actually, my very good colleague, Shanna Swan, has written a book about this called Countdown. And she describes this progressive and linear decrease in sperm numbers. It just keeps on rolling on. Whatever is causing it is not something that's going away. And if it continues, then sperm numbers will decline to a point where it starts to have biological consequences in terms of fertility. So, so these sperm counts are declining. They're declining at a rate which is too fast to be genetic. So it's not genetic, it has to be environmental. And I guess the debates are now going on as to what that environmental cause might be. One of the major hypotheses is that in the 21st century, men are under estrogenic attack. So this estrogen comes from many different sources. Globally, we're seeing a pandemic of obesity. If men are overweight or obese, then they have high levels of estrogen in their blood, just generated naturally. If they're old, and as we push out the ages, when couples are having children, more and more middle-aged men are having children. As you age, your estrogen levels in your blood increased. There is a lot of estrogen-type compounds in the foods that we eat, both dairy products and also plant products. Soy products have a lot of estrogen. And finally, and this is the one that Shanna Swan focuses on, there are a lot of estrogenic contaminants in our environment, and these are industrial pollutants like bisphenol A and the phthalate esters, all of which have an estrogenic kind of activity. And in my book, The Infertility Trap, I put forward a hypothesis, and it's only a hypothesis, that this estrogen surge, which is coming from all these various sources, is actually driving down testosterone levels. And it's the lower testosterone levels that are causing the reduction in sperm generation. And there's very good evidence to support that. Some fabulous studies in the in Nordic countries, in Israel and the United States. And I think, you know, it's very important now that we focus on this as a concept and start to collect more data to see whether this is valid as a concept. But there is then at least some circumstantial evidence that the decline in sperm count might be related to an increased exposure to estrogen and a decrease in testosterone. The other thing which is male related and incontrovertible and again, very, very powerful is that as societies become more and more advanced, socioeconomically advanced, the incidence of testicular cancer increases exponentially. I produce a graph in the book, which actually surprised me. I just got the databases out and looked at the incidence of testicular cancer plotted against total fertility rate. And as societies become more and more socially economically advanced and fertility rates come down, the incidence of testicular cancer goes up astronomically. And that seems to be a phenomenon all over the world. It's not a US phenomenon or an Australian phenomenon. In my book, I plot graphs for all developed countries, and they all show the same trend. Interestingly enough, in New South Wales, where I am, we have an increase in testicular cancer. But if I look at the local levels of ovarian cancer or cervical cancer, they're either not changing at all in the case of ovarian cancer or actually coming down in the case of cervical cancer. So there is, you know, an aspect of this which is very male-focused, not just female. If there are female cancers that are increasing in modern socioeconomically advanced countries, they would be uterine cancer and breast cancer. And all these three cancers, then testicular cancer, uterine cancer, and breast cancer, all increasing in socioeconomically advanced countries and all share a dependence on estrogen. So, you know, I think it's possible to put forward at least a plausible hypothesis that this high estrogen load within the environment is not just driving down sperm counts. That, if you like, is the tip of the iceberg. It's doing much more to the developmental normality of reproductive tissues and sowing the seeds for increases in testicular, uterine, and breast cancer in modern developed countries. And all of these cancers, as I said, are increasing where levels of socioeconomic development are high. So this, I think, is very concerning. And, you know, it is a worry that reproductive toxicology is not doesn't have a higher profile than it has now. I think we should be very worried about this. We should have much more effort being put into the surveilling compounds that are released into the environment for potential estrogenic activity. And in my book, I call for a kind of an increased profile for reproductive toxicology. I think we've underestimated just how important reproductive toxicants can be. And whilst, you know, drugs will go through many types of screens in order to introduce them into clinical usage, reproductive toxicology is at the bottom of the ladder. And in fact, I know that many advanced pharmaceutical companies have abandoned their reproductive toxicology departments because there was no legal need to have data on reproductive toxicity. Well, I think that's a mistake, and we should try to turn that around.
So does that include even the household items that we use, for example, cooking the coverings of our pans and pots?
Yes, so certainly the phthalate esters are plasticizers, and they are, for example, they're in the bottles where you keep the water that you subsequently drink during the course of the day. So people who have plastic drink bottles taking on board estrogenic activities through the plastics that they come in contact with, through the food that they eat. Unfortunately, the meat industry still in many parts of the world is injecting its cattle with steroids in order to put on muscle mass, and then those steroids are in the meat and we subsequently eat the meat. There's a lot of phytoestrogen in the foods that we a lot of soy protein, for example, in the foods that we eat. Really, this has not been studied enough. I think it's a very important area, but it's not something which has received priority. But I think it should, basically.
So let's talk about the implications of the falling birth rates and higher infertility. So what are the main concerns for you?
So I guess my major concern is that all the various factors that we've been talking about are, that is to say, the increase in female education and the delay of childbirth until it's too late, the appearance of toxicants in the environment can have reproductive effects. There's no sign that these things are abating, and indeed these things seem to be increasing in importance as we go forward. And then overlaid on top of that is a sort of longer term evolutionary aspect that I don't want us to forget, because I think it's going to be very important in the long term. So when we were at a very early stage of socioeconomic development, at Paleolithic times, or even when in Victorian London, family sizes were very large. So in Victorian London, the average family size was 11. And you had to have a large number of children because there was a high rate of infant mortality, and many of those children were going to die. And under those conditions, you're always selecting for high fertility genes. You have to be capable of having 11 children in order for one or two to survive and pass your genes on into the next generation. If you were only capable of having one or two children, you probably, that they wouldn't survive and you wouldn't be contributing to the gene pool. And then as you go through the demographic transition and you get more and more sophisticated methods of healthcare, and we're able to prevent infant mortality pretty much absolutely, then family sizes come down, and you know, an average family size in Australia now would be what, 1.6, 1.7. Under those circumstances, there's really no selection for high fertility genes. Even if you can't have any children, you can in many cases go for IVF treatment, and that will help you have the family that you desire. So the result of all of this is that there will be an increase in infertility just naturally, because we're no longer selecting for high fertility genes. We've seen this in animals. So in the racehorse industry, for example, you select horses on their ability to win races. That's what you focus on. And you don't think about fertility, so you don't focus on fertility. And the result is that the fertility of racehorses is very low. Say the same thing in the dairy industry. You select cattle on the basis of milk yield. And if you select just for milk yield and don't think about fertility, then fertility declines. So if you don't select for something, you lose it. And so there's going to be a background of declining infertility that's going to have an impact long term. And then on top of that, you have to layer the IVF industry. Roughly a third of all IVF or all infertility is due to genetic factors. So what the IVF industry does is to enable those people with these poor fertility genes to have children. And it doesn't matter, as long as IVF is a cottage industry accounting for less than 1% of the population. But nowadays, in some countries, up to 10% or more of the population are the product of assisted conception procedures. So if a substantial proportion of your population is made up of people conceived by IVF, this is just exacerbating the retention of poor fertility genes in the population. And this, you know, will create for governments and for health services a dilemma about how you provide reproductive health care for a population where if 30 or 40% of the population require such treatment to have children. And the one thing you can be absolutely sure of is if we get to that situation, the more we use assisted conception in one generation, the more we're going to need it in the next. So this thing will just spiral upwards and be very difficult to control. So it's the sort of trajectory of all these changes. I don't think we don't have a crisis now, but if you take what's going on in terms of environmental pollution, social change, and evolutionary change, and project it forwards, then we could well find ourselves in a very difficult position. And I guess the other thing which is happening, which is really important as well, is that all industrialized societies are showing a change in their age structure. So traditionally, an African country like Madagascar would have a triangular age structure, a broad base at the bottom with lots of young people being born, and then gradually going to a narrow tip for the few people who manage to make it through middle age and into old age. But in modern industrialized society, that population pyramid has been turned on its head. So you now have a very small number of children coming into the population, supporting a large crown of elderly people, the so-called super aged societies, where a significant proportion of the population is over 65. So this, again, creates in the future, will create a problem for us, because you now will have a small workforce working all the hours that God sends in order to support this large population of elderly people who require support. And there are only two ways that I can think of that you can solve that problem. One is to raise retirement age. So you just say, well, you can't retire. You've got to keep working. And, you know, Macron tried this in France, and you the riots that resulted from that political decision are there for everybody to see. And the other obvious thing to do is to get more and more of your female population into the workforce. That's the other way that you can help create support for the older members of society. But the more you do that, the more you constrain their fertility or their opportunities to have children. So you just make a bad situation worse. So these are the kinds of things that that worry me. It's not the, I think at the moment we're traveling along okay, but if you look at the changes that are taking place, they are going to have a potentially very damaging effect downstream. And I think it is inevitable that the human population will decline. That's incontrovertible. That's bound to happen. But it's the rate and the severity of that decline is the thing we have to worry about. And if it's uncontrolled, if the population declines too fast, then there are major issues there for governments to think about in terms of the way they manage their economies, the way they manage their workforces, the way they control the environments in which we live. All of these things are going to play out and could lead us into a great deal of strife. So I guess my fundamental message with this book is to try to get people aware that these things are happening, so that we can try to address them before they become very serious.
What are the things that we should do now to prevent it turning into outright crisis?
Yes. So what are the things that we should be doing now? Well, I guess one of the things that we should be doing is thinking about the structure of society and the way that we engineer social change in order to support young families who want to have children. In other words, parental leave schemes have to become a political priority. If you don't want your population to continue to decline, your fertility rates to continue to decline, you have to think about the political and social changes you need to support young families having children. That's one obvious thing. Second thing is we have to be much more careful about monitoring reproductive toxicants in the environment. This, again, needs to be made a priority of environmental protection agencies. This is, you know, we think about toxicants that threaten human life. And in a way, this is doing the same thing. It's just that you don't, you know, die of reproductive failure, but it does impair your ability, obviously, to contribute to the next generation. We need to gain a deeper understanding of the causes of human infertility. So we still don't understand why most people are infertile. And what's tended to happen is the IVF industry has now become an industry, and it's used as the default treatment for all kinds of infertility that we don't understand. As long as we can get an egg from the female partner and a sperm from the male partner and put them together, we're happy to just go to IVF. But we should stop using IVF as a default treatment and really try to understand much better what the causes of human infertility are, so that we can address them at source. Instead of just solving the problem, we try to understand why the problems occurred. As I've already said, I think we also need to raise the profile of reproductive toxicology in pharmaceutical companies. So the compounds that we are releasing into the environment, the compounds that we are developing for clinical use, are reproductively safe. And, you know, fundamentally, we need to completely revise how we address sex education So sex education, as it currently is conveyed, is something which originated in Victorian times and has an absolute focus on preventing teenage pregnancies. It's, you know, it's about convincing people that if a man comes into even close proximity with a woman, it's likely to generate an unwanted child that will cause problems for everybody. But that's just not the reality. The truth is that fertility is not a tap that you can turn on and off. It's actually something which is quite fragile and is there for a short period of time and then it's gone forever. So we really need to revise the way that we teach sex education to young people and get them to understand just how fragile their reproductive system is and to look after it. And finally, and most importantly, I think we need to improve socio-political awareness about the change that's about to come. As I've said, a decline of human population is inevitable. It's going to start in about 10, 20 years' time. And then if we don't address all these issues, it's going to be very steep and could be very damaging. So we just need to improve people's awareness that this is going to happen to us as a species and try to generate some level of control over the changes that are in many ways inevitable.
And what discoveries in your research for your book, The Infertility Trap, surprised you the most?
Well, I think the graph that kind of took my breath away was the one that I generated showing the increase in testicular cancer rates as fertility rates get close to replacement level, get close to two. So as societies go through the demographic transition and limit their fertility, you suddenly see this exponential increase in testicular cancer rates. So something is happening in these advanced industrial societies, which is having a major impact on the development of the testis. And in the book, I guess what I've done is to tie this in with what is also happening in terms of uterine cancer and breast cancer, which are also increasing rapidly in modern industrialized societies, and trying to draw a thread that brings all those things together through exposure to estrogenic compounds. So that, from a scientific perspective, was to me the most a powerful thing that came out of this. Many of the other things I was aware of, and this was, I guess, in many ways, less of a voyage of discovery for me, but more a kind of my attempts to try and to communicate things. Because I give a lot of public lectures on reproduction, and I'm always surprised by how little people understand of their own reproduction. I come across all kinds of strange beliefs about the reproductive system, which people harbor and influence their behavior. So I think being able to communicate the realities of reproductive health to people is a very important thing. And that gave me a lot of satisfaction to be able to do that.
And do you ever consider some of those more science fiction sort of ways to address this problem, you know, like having artificial wombs that carry children in the future?
That's a very interesting question. Funnily enough, when I was lecturing undergraduates, one of the things I used to get them to speculate about the future of human reproduction, what will this look like in centuries to come? And I think we all predicted that IVF would become more and more prevalent as it has done. We could predict that it's going to be used for more and more cases of it, different kinds of infertility, which it has done. But at the same time, obstetricians and perinatologists were developing ways of keeping babies alive that are produced very immaturely. And it's only a matter of time before the two ends of that process meet, and it's possible to have the whole of human development take place in vitro. And indeed, when I was growing up as a scientist in Cambridge, there were people working in Cambridge on just this. So the exogenesis, the idea that you could create an embryo and culture it to term outside of the womb was something that people were interested in trying to do. It's extremely difficult. You can get an embryo to grow to the point where it's got a beating heart, but it doesn't develop much more. One of the things that actually defeats you in a tissue culture system is gravity. I don't know that those problems are ever going to be surmountable. So I think IVF will become more and more part of the reproductive spectrum. As I've said, there are some countries now where it's 10%, but the vector is inexorably upwards. So I see more and more children being produced by IVF. And I think this does create a problem for governments about how you provide this healthcare. If 20 or 30% of your population are needing IVF, how do you provide that? You can't have a situation where only the rich are able to pay for the treatment to have children. You'd think that having children would be socially an inalienable right. Mm-hmm. So this will create a lot of pressure on governments and national health services to solve if we don't do something about it and try to get a better hand on why human fertility is declining.
Well, this has been a truly insightful discussion. So can you tell us what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
I don't know that I've got another book in me. I shall wait to see how this book goes before I write another one. I would like to write another book. And if I was to write another book, it would be about sexual differentiation. Again, I find people don't really understand how the two genders are created and all the shades of gray in between. So I think that's something that could do with some scientific input, and I'd like to write a book about that. But I'll see how this book goes before I commit to another. Otherwise, I'm spending a lot of time continuing my work in reproduction. One of the discoveries we made as a research group is that a lot of infertility is due to oxidative stress. And my research group is currently working very hard on developing ways to both diagnose oxidative stress in infertile couples and developing ways to treat that oxidative stress that doesn't mean that you have to take recourse to IVF, that it can be addressed pharmaceutically, which is what we hope. So that's one of the major things that I'm doing currently.
And what would be the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, the book is freely available from all good and probably bad booksellers around the globe. You find it on Amazon and Booktopia and all the usual outlets. It's available both as an electronic copy and as a hard copy, paperback copy. Details of our work are on our university website. So if you go to the University of Newcastle in Australia and look at the Priority Research Centre in Reproductive Health, you will find examples of the kind of work that we get up to. And those are the major ways, I think. And I still do give a fair number of lectures. So hopefully people may stumble across me giving a lecture on this topic at some point in the future.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
It was an enormous pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.